Hello, and thank you for joining me for the 8th episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the University of Arizona's Arizona Institutes for Resilience and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change and discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis, which indeed it is. Today, we're talking about one of my favorite topics, at least for a little bit, food. We are exploring local food systems. We are going to talk about the impact of the pandemic, longstanding inequities, what resilience looks like around food systems, and how we create the future we need. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. Food systems, pandemics, equity, and the future. Let me repeat that, because tying them all together is real, it's urgent, and it's critical for more and more people to recognize the connection between pandemics, equity, and our future. Quite frankly, I am honored to have two people who are going to not only tie these together, but shed some light on the pandemic's impact on the food system resilience, and the longstanding inequities in the food system. And hopefully, on an up note, if we can get there, discussion about more positive paths forward. With me is Dr. Laurel Belante, PhD Assistant Professor and Director, Food Studies Degree and Assistant Director, the Center for Regional Food Studies, and Dr. Gigi Owen, Research Scientist, Climate Assessment for the Southwest. So welcome to both of you, and we've already had a lot of fun off air. So thank you for being here and taking the time to talk about these critical issues with us today.
Thanks for having us.
So before I dive in, and I always like, how much should I say about the guests? Well, in both of your cases, I want to say more than I normally do, because I think it shares with our listeners, like, who are you dealing with here? These are like big deals. They are doing a lot of work. So let me read a little bit about them. Dr. Gigi Owen is a research scientist with Climate Assessment for the Southwest. It's called CLIMAS program. And CLIMAS supports transdisciplinary and participatory climate research and is housed in the University of Arizona's Institute for Resilience, also known as AIR. As qualitative social science with training in geography and political ecology, Gigi's research interests center on interactions between humans and their environments. Her current research involves understanding if and how local adaptation strategies help people address impacts of climate change. It is so critical. We're not raising awareness about climate change. We are in the adaptation phase. She has worked on air, land, and water quality issues across the Arizona-Sonora border region, and spent 2 years studying the ecology of desert grasslands in Sonora, Mexico. Thus, my desire to have at least three shows with these two women. So here's Laurel Belante, PhD, is Assistant Professor of Practice and Director of the BA in Food Studies and the Assistant Director of the Center for Regional Food Studies, CRFS, at the University of Arizona. She is a human environment geographer specializing in food justice, global environmental change, sustainable food systems, and agrarian questions in both the United States and Mexico. In her role, Dr. Belante oversees curriculum development and engagement opportunities for the food studies degree. She teaches several courses in the area of critical food studies, including Introduction to Critical Food Studies, Food Justice, Ethics, and Activism, and the Senior Capstone. Translation, they both wear many hats. So I'm glad I decided to do that for the two of you, because to me, it's illustrative of the, not just the magnitude and scope of what you're involved in, but the integration of those disciplines, of those critical areas that we have to think about, not in a silo, but together. So as I said to both of you, my biggest challenge is, where's a good starting point? So I think we should start about with food, because that makes me smile. And other than people not being able to get some food that they are used to buying and the occasional empty shelves, I'd like you both to take us a deeper journey on the impacts of the food system throughout the pandemic. And, you know, this is a national show that airs all over the country at the very least. So let's dive into the State of Tucson Food System Report, because even though it's focused on, you know, Tucson and Pima County, there's these challenges everywhere, and it might wear a different hat. It might be too much water. It might be this. It might be that. So, Laurel, do you want to start? It's like eeny, meeny. Do you want to start about this report? And there'll be a link in the show notes. But the State of Tucson Food System Report informs. I mean, it covers so much. And I said to both of you, can we just do this one for the first show? So give us the Reader's Digest version or the long, full narrative of the report and some of the things you learned from it.
Absolutely. So the State of the Tucson Food System Report is a report that we put out every year at the Center for Regional Food Studies. And when the pandemic hit in back March 2020, Gigi and I were in touch about our mutual interest in understanding the local food system in Pima County and how it had been impacted by COVID. And we just realized that given all of the shifts that were happening, that it was really important to take an initial snapshot of how the pandemic was affecting the people and the places that produce food for our local food community here in Tucson and in surrounding areas throughout Pima County. So we set out to do a rapid assessment of our local food system in 2020. So we did about 40 interviews with people working throughout the food system. So that includes everyone from producers, distributors, processors, restaurants, and institutions and organizations that do hunger relief. We also distributed a survey to food producers to understand specifically how farmers and ranchers were coping with the pandemic. So what is available in the State of the Food System report for last year, I think we presented it in May of 2021, is really looking at an initial snapshot of how is COVID playing out in our local food system and how were all of these different components of our food system responding to those impacts. And what we found was that as was seen across the country and in many places of the world, there was a rapid increase in consumer interest in the local food system when COVID first hit. So especially as we saw initial panic buying and empty store shelves and people really concerned about COVID outbreaks happening at food processing plants and meat processing plants, agricultural fields, mile-long lines of cars waiting to get emergency food relief. There was this heightened sense of concern among consumers of, oh, wow, where does my food come from? And we really take for granted those store shelves always being stocked with products from all over the world and that we can go there and get whatever we want at any time that we want, given assuming that we have the resources to do so, right? And that initial shock really created some interesting impacts throughout our local food system. And what we saw in the research was that at the same time, there was a lot of disruption in the typical supply chains that have been kind of the forte of the local food system, which is local food being sent out to restaurants and institutions. And with the shutdowns of schools and restaurants, all of a sudden those typical supply chains were really disrupted. And you had all of these producers that had crops in the ground, were ready to go to harvest and send that food out. And all of a sudden, all of these contracts were canceled. And so there was a real rapid scramble that had to happen in our local food system to make sure that those crops still got harvested, still got distributed, that farmers still got paid, and that ultimately consumers had something to eat. And interviewing people that were involved in all these efforts, it is just really a testament to the people in the community of Southern Arizona that there was such a remarkable outpouring of support and ingenuity and cooperation and flexibility, that there was just really amazing things that happened in that time period.
So you know, when you're talking and when I was reading the report, one of my best visuals and something that I do in my writing is I talk about the pebble in the pond. And what I was so attracted by and transfixed by in this report is, so you have the bomb, the pandemic, there's the first pebble. And then you just painted a picture for us of how that ripple effect is so widespread. There are the producers, there are the distributors, there are the restaurateurs, there are a food, you know, food and agriculture organizations, and all of those help support our economy. I mean, let's face it, it's not just about our food, it's about jobs and being able to afford your rent. And what this report is, and I rarely beg my listeners to do anything, so I'm not going to beg, but I highly encourage all of you listening, because you're such a loyal, wonderful tribe, to click on the link and read their lessons from the pandemic, because it will inform you for going forward. So Gigi, what would you add to that? Because that was a pretty darn good summary of what happened. But from your perspective, what was happening for you as a critical part of this project?
Yeah, it's, where do I start?
That's how I felt when I was preparing for the show, you guys. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And I called Kelly and I said, Kel, one show, really? This is a minimum of a 3-part series. So I'm glad that you affirmed my feelings. So please go on. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a really big deal. And I think, you know, I guess it's really made us think about how we think about disasters and crisis. So when we were first doing this or thinking about this study, that was when you were seeing the empty store shelves and people were being furloughed or laid off. And so we could see this like crisis moment coming to a head pretty quickly, that the supply chains were breaking down and people were out of work, so, you know, wouldn't be able to afford food potentially. And there was a really large response to that. You know, there's several mutual aid groups that sprung up. Obviously, the food bank was crucial in distributing food boxes. There was a lot of coordination around that moment, and it kind of held us through a particular amount of time. And I think what we can learn from this moving forward around disaster and crisis is that, you know, in the moment we'll rally.
Right.
People have relationships with each other.
Right.
They're going to figure out the solutions in the moment that make the most sense to help the most people. But, you know, I think what this made really clear is that we need to do a better job kind of planning for not only these crisis moments, but kind of the longer term, kind of maybe slower types of crisis or disasters. So thinking about just the food insecurity that we have on a regular basis.
Right.
And so how do we learn lessons from the crisis moment to apply to addressing the longer term or underlying food insecurity? How do we look towards planning for climate change and the impacts that that might have on food production and distribution and consumption, and make some of those changes now? So I think that's, to me, the additional piece of what we found or kind of are looking towards in these lessons of our report is like, what can we do now to plan for the future? And I guess just a few things to highlight is that there are so many people here locally doing really great things in our food system. And one of the biggest kind of grassroots things that ended up in state policy last year was the Agricultural Workforce Development Program. And that is to help train like the next generation of farmers,
right,
and producers who may not have, you know, grown up as in like a farming family, or may not have access to those resources of like starting a farm and the training behind all of that. And that was really put forward by members of the AHO Center for Sustainable Agriculture, the AHO CSA, and
yes, oh my goodness, yes,
the Southern Arizona Young Farmers and Rancher Coalition, and so that was really something that was like, here's this community need, and we know we need this to support the food system, and they, you know, worked with a lot of different people to build up support for that, and now there's, you know, that was in the budget for this year, so there's things like that that are happening and just need to be kind of like bolstered in order to kind of take these lessons that are learned and really address those underlying food insecurity, kind of long-term disaster types of issues.
And I want to go back to something you both said. Like, we think if you ask an eighth grader, let's just say a sixth grader, where does your lettuce come from? They'll say Safeway or Albertsons. They're not going to, most kids, and I don't blame them. When I was six or seven, I didn't think where my lettuce came from. But in this case, with a pandemic, with already so many longstanding inequities in the food system, I mean, have you shifted from talking about, and I'm going to go back to when I first started Mrs. Green's World, and I was talking about, and I kind of, you know, self-effacing, and we're going to raise awareness about climate change and blah, 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 blah. Well, now we don't talk about climate change and raising awareness, because if you're not on this train, then I don't have any time to talk about that anymore. What we're talking about is adaptation and resilience. That's where we are now. So I want to ask both of you, how is Tucson positioned or positioning itself, for the next round? Because I think, talking to lots of scientists a lot, this is not the last pandemic, folks. I wanted to think that about 2 years ago, and I'm like, no, it's not. There's going to be other variants. There's going to be other encroachment where, you know, if it's not a bat, it's a bunny. So what are the two of you, I'd love your perspectives on, does the focus have to be on local food system resilience, and what does that mean? How's that?
So
I know you can answer it.
I'll take a stab, and then I'd love to hear Gigi's thoughts as well. You know, Tucson and Southern Arizona is such an interesting place, and we have this unique position as a city, a UNESCO City of Gastronomy, right? So in 2015, we received that designation, and there's really clear signs that a lot of focus is being driven on food-driven economic development for Tucson and metro area. And that's really exciting, and it has some really interesting positive dimensions to it. But I think something that we're really focused on in our research lab is thinking about, well, you know, if we're really taking seriously that we want local food to be a part of how this, you know, part of economic development, part of branding, right, of this region, part of identity of this region, then we also need to take seriously the need for system-wide planning for that,
right,
food, right? And it's, you know, something that came out very clearly in our interviews is that right now there's a real disconnect between the kind of consumer interest in local food and then the actual capacity and infrastructure that's available to support that demand. And there's, you know, a lot of people that are working in this system are kind of you know, holding their breath to see, there's already a tension between the supply and demand issues, with demand starting to outpace supply. And, you know, Arizona has one of the worst replacement rates for farmers in the nation. I think it's something like farmers over 65 are outnumbering 5-1 farmers that are under 35, right? So there's this real intense need to address the workforce that is undergirds that system, to create new farmers and ranchers and provide the opportunities to access land and water to support a local food system. There's, of course, the climate change issues, which have been mentioned, a lot of water issues coming down. And so that's what we're really trying to focus in on in our lab is understanding, you know, if we're taking seriously that we want a local food system, which I always like to say that local food is not just about food, right? It's about relationships.
Right.
It's about
right.
access to connection to nature and land and a connection to where our food comes from, to your point, you know, about just a general consciousness about how food is produced and how it gets to our tables. And so anyhow, we can go on and on about why I think there's very good arguments for us to maintain a local food system. But there's a lot of really challenging work that needs to be done. And there's some positive, you know, there's amazing people in this region that are doing a lot of hard work to address the, you know, to address those issues. But we still, for example, something that is high on our minds right now is like, we still don't have a high functioning local food policy council in Tucson or in Pima County. There's the Pima County Food Alliance, but that's an all volunteer run organization. And there's really a need for people to be focusing on the kind of policies that we need in this region to make the changes and the long-term work that's necessary to really bolster the system.
It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. And Gigi, do you want to weigh in on any of that at all? You're sitting there with, yeah, well, we have to talk about this too.
Yeah, I guess just picking up on that last piece of food policy, I think that's one thing that I personally have learned through doing this research is the need to have the policies in place that are going to help us distribute kind of like, you know, federal funding and state funding towards supporting, you know, more local and regional foods. The people should be able to grow food for themselves and their communities if that's the way that they want to go. They should be able to have small and medium scale farms and not all farms should be large and corporate.
Right.
But the way that our, you know, our state Department of Agriculture and a lot of the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture has been set up, they support and subsidize these large scale kind of corporate farms and haven't paid attention to the different needs of kind of more local, regional scale, small and medium farms. And so that's where I see a lot of the policy needing to go is understanding the needs of people who want to have, you know, family farms, who want to have cooperative farms, who want to have these kind of different models of not, I guess, just not even just farms, you know, growing food, but also producing the food and you know, kind of keeping more of these like local food systems work going. They need to be supported. And so we need to figure out what are the policies that are going to best support them? What are their needs? Kind of, we really need to be able to listen more to what they need and kind of bring that up to county level policy and state level policy. And hopefully at some point too, kind of, you know, even federal policy, where some of these support policy supports and funding supports are going directly to farmers who are farmers and food businesses that are directly feeding people in their communities.
Right. And I mean, both of you, it just blows me away because one of my frustrations back in the day when I started is, you know, you had your solar people and your water people and your food people and your energy people. And to me, when I was reading what you have done in this study and the approach that you have taken, it's all of it, people. It's everything. It's water and how we are going to put the water on the crops. And then people don't think about transportation because if there's nobody working to get the gasoline distributed, and hopefully at some point it'll be, you know, renewable energy, but it isn't there. It isn't even close there in the trucking world. And we're talking about starvation. And of course, it emphasizes what I call the great divide because most of us, all of us on this call will probably figure out ways to survive because of where we are on the food chain. I mean, I kid you not, I've had many discussions with Diana Liverman about this and who's going to be impacted. And what you're talking about is something that could, in one scenario, dramatically impact all of us. It doesn't matter how much money you have, if the product isn't available to buy it, it's not going to be there. So where does the conversation about resilience fit in succinctly? So if we have more local food systems and food growers and even community gardens, is that helping us get closer to a truly resilient community? That's one question. Does it? And then the other question is, does it help at all when it comes to the social justice component? Because I have a garden, which I never had in my whole life. It's a big fat pain in the butt. I mean, it wants to be watered every day. I have to prune stuff. I went out there and we had a big weekend and I'm like, oh my God. But I'm going out taking tomatoes off of my garden and oranges off my tree, but that's not going to sustain me. You know what I mean? So where's the resilience part? And what has to happen? Are you guys leading the parade?
Yeah, so we think a lot about resilience and what does it mean to be resilient? And there's a lot of different definitions for that, right?
Right.
And I think that what we saw happen in the food system with COVID was that there was a lot of response. And, it could have been a lot worse. But I think that what we saw in terms of inequalities was that certain neighborhoods and, there's a lot of inequities across racial divide and income.
Right.
And so, it's like I would be interested in hearing more from people in those communities about their experiences with, about getting food in terms of resilience, because I don't think we're getting the full picture. If we look at numbers of, food need across, if we look across Tucson, it might not have been as bad as they thought. But I think if you look in certain neighborhoods,
right,
it was worse than others. And so
right,
we really need to be questioning what does resilience look like on a community level and who benefits from that and who's making those, whose experiences are informing the policies that are designed to create a more resilient system. And again, kind of looking beyond just the crisis moment, but how do we be resilient on kind of a longer term level and an everyday level and not just in these acute crisis response modes.
Right, right. Very, very, very good point. So Laurel, do you want to add to that?
Sure, yeah. Just to add to what Gigi's been saying, I think, a critique that's often circulated about resilience is that it kind of celebrates ability of a system to bounce back to the state it was in prior to the crisis. And what we really saw in our study and what we're thinking a lot about in our research lab is that we need to go beyond just bouncing back to that baseline place where we were, because as we know, the baseline is full of inequities.
And it really stunk to begin with.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And so full of long-term challenges. And so, what we're thinking about right now is in what ways does COVID, the experience of COVID, show us the factors of resilience that really highlight the importance of local food systems, because there is plenty, and our report really goes into that. There's some the strength of the social fabric and the connections between organizations and the relationships of trust that undergird the system that we have right now, all of that is really powerful material for resilience, and that has been borne out throughout the COVID pandemic in how the system has responded. And so there are already really good ingredients present, but you talk to anyone, working at the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona or at the Young Farmers Coalition, or we haven't even really touched on the kind of rural-urban divide and all of the extreme issues that are facing rural populations and tribal populations that you know, don't benefit from the local food system that we celebrate here in Metro Tucson.
Right.
So you talk to anyone in these different parts of the food system, and they'll tell you that, you know, we've got some really great ingredients, but we're not nearly at the level that we need to be to address the kinds of transformational change that's needed to really make a food system that's just and equitable. And, you know, as much as I am a fierce advocate of local food systems, and I really believe in the value of us all having a connection to the earth and to the food and to the food producers, I'm also, you know, not about a rose-colored, you know, a rosy
right.
view of it either.
Right.
You know, I think we have to be really practical about what makes sense. You know, we have to look at our local environment and understand what does make sense to grow here, what does not, right? Like, we're never going to have locally grown coffee here, or or chocolate, yeah. And you know, all the things that come from far away. But, you know, does it make sense to make sure that we have a really like steady supply of fresh greens and other produce that doesn't have a long shelf life, that needs to be, you know, and that's a really key component of a healthy, complete diet, right? So I think that's one part of the question, is looking at like what makes sense, you know, from an environmental and contextual perspective for the food system to be local. And then the other part of it is addressing this equity piece, which is, you know, really being honest that historically the local food system has really served primarily white elite consumers. And, you know, and it's not a bad thing to say that and to say it openly. I mean, there's a lot of
truth.
People working
it's
in the system, right?
Yeah.
They're really aware of it. And I'd say, you know, on top of COVID, like all of the, you know, the ongoing issues of violence and, you know, the murder of George Floyd and a lot of, there's been a lot of upwelling of consciousness about the need to address racial and economic disparities. And, you know, people that are working in the food system have that really high on their radar because they, you know, these are people that care about their community. They care about the people, and they don't want to just be feeding people that can pay a high price for their food, right? They want to be feeding the people that that live and work here, and oftentimes the very workers themselves that are in, you know, that are sustaining this local food system are the people that need to have food stamps and access to emergency food aid. And so I guess that was a long-winded response.
No, it wasn't. I was captivated because you are spot on. And it is white privilege, and it's the Great Divide, and it's socioeconomic differences, that the vaster they become and the greater the divide is, to me, the more vulnerable we all are as a community and as a country. I mean, it's like, yeah, you can think that you're lucky because you can afford. I got the biggest shock over the holidays because I don't eat beef. And someone told me they had a crown roast. And I was like, I had like this moment of thinking, well, my mother used to make crown roast like 50 years ago. It was $250 for Christmas dinner. And they can afford it. They don't buy it every week. And I kept saying to my friend, $250? And she said, yeah, how much did you think they were? And I said, well, I haven't bought beef for 10 years, so I would have said like $75. And everybody laughed at me. But it's dramatic. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a dramatic story mm-hmm. about what we're facing. And I don't in no way want to cast aspersions on my friends because it was a big dinner and, you know, on and on, and they could afford it. So let me get off of that. Like, I feel like I'm on the soapbox.
If I can just add to that, you know, we need money to sustain the system, right? And so if there's not some sort of subsidies or sliding scale system of how to purchase that food, then we do need those consumers that have that high income level to you know, put their money where their mouth is, you know, the whole like voting with your fork. Like there are good reasons to advocate for that, but there's also good reason to, you know, get out the magnifying glass and say, hey, let's really take an honest look at who's benefiting most from you know, this quote unquote good local food and who's not. And that it needs to be an analysis across the whole system. Also looking at the livelihood of the food producers themselves and the farm workers that are harvesting and so on and so forth.
It's such a complex carbohydrate.
Yeah, I think the, you know, thinking about how much food actually costs, it's expensive. And so that's why, you know, that's where USDA and state supported subsidies for certain types of goods that are produced. That's why some of those are more affordable than a lot of the local options. And so it's definitely not to say that food producers or small businesses, like, they need to be paid the appropriate amounts for producing these or, you know, yes, selling these items. And so that's where there's a tension there of, like, people who are doing this work in, you know, to make food for your table need to be compensated fairly. And that's where we need kind of the bigger structural support from, you know, the state, the county, the federal government to kind of make those options, make local and regional options affordable for people. And there's a lot of different ways that can be done and is being done to some degree.
But we don't pay the true cost of food. You're so right. We don't. And when I have this dream that I'm going to write my second book, and one of them is going to be about the farm bill and picking it apart because of the subsidies. And in my opinion, okay, the rich getting richer. And friends of mine have land in Georgia, I think, and they are getting subsidized to not grow pecans. Mm-hmm. I kid you not. It's like, what? They don't even think it's right. And there's no way to turn the money back. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's a very complex set of things. So what I hear both of you saying, and it was in the report, and I got to tell you, I know I sound a little bit overly dramatic about how this report impacted me, but it's not. It did. It really did. So even though this got me, and I underline it and got my red pen out, you know, the old-fashioned way, COVID has caused many disruptions and other challenges in our world. Did it just put a spotlight on so many things that are already there? Because I want to say, you know what, folks? We got bigger fish to fry than getting everybody vaccinated, even though I believe it's really important. We got a water crisis. We're having a food crisis. There's when you talk about the lack of support for farmers, infrastructure, all of these things are there and were present before the pandemic. Has this helped put a little bit of a light on it, or is it being forgotten?
So one of the things that we're doing right now in our research lab is we're moving from asking questions about the initial crisis of COVID, thinking about early 2020, right, to now examining what does this chronic pandemic mean, you know?
I love that, chronic pandemic. I don't really love it, but thank you.
Yeah, that it's just been, you know, we're all like waiting for it to end and it keeps going on and on. And so what we've been doing in our research lab is conducting a series of focus groups now with people working throughout the food system and looking at how this chronic pandemic is playing out for them in their organizations and their businesses. And we're also asking, what are the unexpected upsides of this crisis? And you know, several people talk about like that one of the best parts of the pandemic has been showing that things can be changed.
Yes.
You know, that these are human built systems.
Yes.
And that means they are also changeable.
It's really about the whole, to me, listening to this about the systemic approach when it comes to COVID, but there are many other challenges that have to be integrated into whatever we do going forward. I think that's where I wanted to take it, because we need some long-term stability. We need to increase the capacity of our local food system. And COVID, like I said, I had this visual that like it put a big flipping flashlight on that. Like, we have gaps, people, and they're called food gaps. So we better get our act together. And I just don't want the show to be over without talking about AHO, because I know a lot about that project. And that was funded by the Community Foundation of Southern Arizona. It was a big deal. And look what it has reaped. So philanthropy coming into the conversation is important too. It's like the whole hands on deck. So Gigi, if you don't have anything to add, I have a lot more questions.
Great. Yeah.
So I want to try to like move forward to, you mentioned casually about building a food policy network and the importance of that, because your recommendations, like I was so down reading this report, knowing what I know, and then reading, of course, your researchers, and you come up with solutions and what is it going to take. So can you field that? Because there are very concrete, understandable by the John Q. Public, of which I am a member, what needs to happen? And that's my first question. I hope remember the second part. How fast? Like I always say to people in this field, like Jim Beiser and Kathy Jacobs and those people, how much time do we have? And they just kind of look at me and laugh and say, the crystal ball did not come with this job, Gina. So I don't know how much time we have, but what are some of the most critical recommendations that you both feel need to be implemented like yesterday?
Gosh. You know, I think the first thing that needs to be done is, you know, on our end, I guess I'll take it as like a researcher stance.
Right.
You know,
right.
I think we really need to hear and listen to the people who were most affected. And because those are the types of experiences that should really inform our planning. And so, you know, if we're talking about also that the food system has, or, you know, that a lot of people who can afford
a $250 crown roast.
Yes.
I'm sorry I ever brought that up. I hope my girlfriends don't get mad at me.
But, you know, it's like, if that's tends to be the consumers who are white and have high incomes, then, and like a lot of those people are also people who have the power to implement policy or support policy, or, you know, are the philanthropists who are supporting things. And I think that that's where we also need to shift who is directing these conversations around what a resilient food system looks like. Mm. We need to be hearing more from, you know, maybe lower income neighborhoods and talking more to populations that had like a higher food need. I mean, there's so many lessons coming out of the Ajo CSA and the Tonatam Nation, and where they came up with really great community strategies to help feed each other, but that was driven by need. I mean, they had one supermarket on the nation, and a lot of people were coming from outside of the nation to shop there because of, you know, the supply chain issues and things. And so they had a very unique set of circumstances and also came up with, you know, solutions that would work for them. And I think that that's where it's like, we need to support the communities and the people who are experiencing these things to develop solutions that work better for them and not have it come from kind of like an outside perspective or someone who isn't experiencing these things.
So I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, maybe Gigi and Laurel want to start a series with me, hanging out with Gina, because there's so many things to this that inspire me and excite me and challenge me and make me depressed. I mean, it's the whole thing about how inextricably bound we are and how unaware so many people are of the connection.
Yeah.
And I just, it's not a judgment. It's just an observation. It's, you know, maybe I'll become a scientist someday. I'm just observing, not judging. But it's really true. People walk around in a bubble, not in any mean-spirited or ignorant way. It's their life. And unless you're having me over for dinner and they say, oh my God, no, don't ask her that. Don't ask her that. Oh my God, she's starting. And I start about all of these things that we're talking about because you're right. There is power among these people to bring about change. And what more important than our food, mm-hmm. which requires water, which requires transportation, which requires energy. It's like, that's a big one. So Laurel, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, you know, just picking up on your question about policy, I know I mentioned it earlier, but, you know, something that is being seen in cities across the nation and is the importance of food policy councils. And I think that's something that we really need to advocate for here in Pima County. And we have great ideas of how that could be built out in a way that actually compensates for those efforts and compensates people throughout the county to be, you know, community representatives and liaisons that communicating the issues from where they are. Because Pima County is big, right? Like, and we
really big.
So
really
typically, big. You know, it's really easy for us here at the university, especially in COVID times when we're in isolation and we're not going out nearly as much. It's easy to forget about how big the county is and get really kind of myopically focused on the city. And we need to be thinking much broader than that. And on, again, like on a systems level. So I think that's one thing that we can advocate for is, you know, building out a food policy council that's not just built on volunteer labor, because again, going back to issues of privilege, as long as we're relying on volunteers to change our food system, you know, that is going to mean that the voices that most need to be heard are not going to be there because
totally.
Those people totally. Are strapped for money, strapped for time, you know, don't have transportation to get to the meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's one thing that needs to be addressed is, you know, creating the resources so that the people that need to be heard in these conversations are compensated for their time and acknowledged for their efforts. And I think the I also wanted to just briefly touch on your question, Gina, about, you know, how much time do we have? And like, you know, this had to be done yesterday.
Do I want to know the answer? You're right. Thank you for being honest.
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry. We're in the right direction. No, we're not, people. Hurry up.
No, I think that's, you know, one of the challenges of being a researcher is that every day you're confronted with the evidence about our changing climate, about environmental issues, about land and water issues, and, you know, human dimensions of this, of hunger and job insecurity. And it can be really easy to get down about it and to feel
hopeless.
It can be paralyzing,
yes.
Right? But,
yes, it can.
You know, I guess I get up every morning and I think we all have a part to play. And if we really took that seriously and believed that, you know, our little grain of sand can contribute to tipping the scales towards the change that we want to see, then I think we'd actually, you know, transformation is possible. And we have to maintain a sense of hope and a sense of optimism, as well as a determination that we're not going to stop, you know, that we're going to keep working and showing up and doing the hard work to make sure that tomorrow's better.
So it's so, gosh, that was inspirational. And I mean it. It's what we all have to do. Don't be self-indulgent like I am on some days. And I think, you know what? I'm just going to go read. And you have to take those days because I think mental health is huge. But then I get back up on the horse and say, where are we riding today, Gina? Because your work matters too, because of the voices like yours that I can get, you know, thousands of people to listen to. And if 10 people start realizing they want to get involved in some food security, food insecurity, alleviation, all of that. It's my mission. It's like, I want to wake people up left and right and to point out the crisis without being hysterical. It's a crisis, but how we navigate, how we curate the solutions. And from where I sit, you guys, we need scientists involved in every conversation, mm-hmm. every conversation, because I have a lot of relationships in this community, and without naming anyone, putting anyone on the spot, sometimes the solutions that my partners come up with, I'm like, whoa, I guess they didn't listen to enough Mrs. Green's World podcast, or I guess they didn't read that report, because food policy impacts everyone. I'm excited about things like the work the YWCA is doing in this area of innovation and food justice and social justice. There's a lot of things to get excited about. So is there anything that you're sitting there, like to me, the fact that it's after 11 o'clock, I'm sitting here saying, what? It's like, didn't we just start 5 minutes ago? Mm-hmm. So there's so much more that could be covered. And I would like to, I want to give some thought to what role I can play with the food policy councils because of my living here for over 50 years and knowing a lot of people. But your work is just so critical and so important. And it was inspirational for me to go down this rabbit hole. So what else do you think needs to be mentioned?
I had a thought when both you and Laurel were talking. You know, I think it is really easy to be overwhelmed by these large issues. And one thing that I've been doing just even in my own personal life, it's like starting a practice, right? So one thing I'm doing right now is I'm painting more, but you know, it's like I need to practice just a little bit every day. And so it's like even doing a little piece of building a practice every day, it builds up to something big. And I think that there's little things everyone can do every day. One of them is just like continuing to build relationships with the people around you. It's that came out as crucial, like these personal connections, you know, connections in your neighborhood, across the city, or, you know, regionally, it can, or even, you know, bigger than that, but reaching out to people and having these social networks is going to be crucial in any kind of everyday life, but also in these moments of crisis. And so like reach out to one person every day is going to just kind of help grow this sense of community on whatever scale that looks like.
I totally agree. Laurel?
Absolutely. I fully agree with that. And I would just add, you know, find a way to be an agitator in whatever.
I love it. You said the magic words, troublemaker, agitator, disruptor for good. Just call Gina. I'm in.
You know, find the way that works for you, you know, for everyone that's going to look different. You know, right now I have a young child at home. I'm pregnant. I'm managing a crazy workload in my work life. And yet I still make time every week to call my senators and to, you know, at least, you know, I think we have to remember to be active citizens and to influence where we can. And to the extent that you can keep your finger on the pulse of local, regional, and federal policy and find ways to have make your voice heard, you know, that's another way that things happen. And, you know, we look at, there's some really awesome things happening at the federal level right now as it relates to the food system. And that is really a result of the social pressure that has been put there and the awareness that has been spread by researchers, by activists, by people that are saying, hey, sound the alarm bells, like this work is important.
And if you do any research at all, and this is for our listeners, if you do any research at all, there is great data about what gets the attention of an elected official, and it would shock you how little it takes. Like if you have 10 friends that call on the same day, some aide in a congressman's office is going to say 10 people called about this. And I will tell you that the county, in my opinion, is moving forward, Pima County, to really take a look at just how critical things are and start shaking things up a little bit. And that's because people at the county are saying, we got to go faster. We got to put this on, you know, an accelerated express lane track and agitating. And people who are citizens of this community need to, I used to call it get your green on, but get your sustainability hat on, because the life you save may be your own or your grandchild or your daughter or whatever. Mm-hmm. We're there. So I'll tell you, I have last words unless you guys want to say anything else.
No, please go ahead. This has been quite a pleasure to be here, so go ahead.
So great. I actually feel blessed to have gotten to interview these two amazing human beings, to learn about their work. You could tell by my enthusiasm to actually recognize how much they care and how invested in our future they are. It's obvious if you're listening carefully, I went down a very deep rabbit hole while doing my research for the show. And it's not just because I love food, which I do. Now, if it had been about chocolate, that would have been the whole deal. But I really do think we are in big trouble. And I don't say that to alarm people. I say that because we need all hands on deck when it comes to addressing the climate crisis and the complexities and all that that statement implies. We need to right the wrongs about food equity and food insecurity. And these two women are focused on change, on what we can do to move forward, and about why it is so vitally important for our survival, not just in this water challenge region, but pretty much in every town and every community in our country. There's something. From where I sit, we are really in big trouble as a planet, big trouble. Before the pandemic, we were in trouble. And now we're getting a picture of just how critical things are. So Laurel and Gigi, thank you for your work, for your commitment to researching, using science, and exploring very complex issues such as our food supply and the interaction between energy systems and innovation and how to incentivize all of the things that you're talking about. I wrote it down. Food policy councils. Wouldn't it be great if I interviewed you a year from now and you said, "We've got it, Gina, we did it. Do you want to be on it?" I probably would say yes. I've said this before on the show, and I never say it without coming from my heart. We really do need you. We need your work and the work of your teams and the students that are engaged. And we all need to realize that we are global citizens who have quite a bit to lose if we don't get on board with bringing about much needed changes and in a hurry, because we all like to eat. And my final thanks is always to you, our wonderful listeners, because we all know without you, there would be no us. So thank you. And Laurel and Gigi, it was truly a pleasure. And thank you so much. I hope our paths cross post-pandemic.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.